Good morning, everybody. I'm going to try to keep us not so much on Jewish time, but on real time, since we don't have too much time in this session, and I have an enormous topic of worship and ritual and transformation. So I'd like to start with a story. My professor of liturgy from HUC, Rabbi Larry Hoffman, taught me this story 20 years ago, but I remembered it. He was at an interfaith conference of liturgists, and because everyone came from different faith traditions, they decided instead of a traditional prayer service that they would just have 5 moments of silence. And so the Buddhists, they sat in deep meditation, and the Christians seemed to be very comfortable in prayer. But for the Jews, one of his Orthodox colleagues said, "I don't think I've ever been that quiet for that long in my entire life." Now, when we Jews pray, we like having a script. We are, after all, the people of the book. And when we talk about worship transformation, oftentimes what we are talking about is, let's write a new prayer book. And we do a pretty good job of that. We've moved from the Union Hymnal to Gates of Prayer and Mishkan Tefillah, and countless congregations have also written their own prayer books. But what I would challenge us to think of is that we should move a little bit beyond the text. The text itself is only a means to an end. Now, when we think of really transformative ritual or worship, the things that make you cry, that make you feel differently when you walk out of a synagogue or out of a wedding ceremony, what happens and changes is not happening up here. It's happening right here. So too often as Jews, we focus on the words of our prayer and our liturgy at the expense of all the other things that make for transformative worship. In that vein, I want to reflect with you that as I was anxiously editing and re-editing this talk for this morning, I was reminded of something that my speech coach had taught me about a year ago. She said, "Angela, only 7% of the effectiveness of your talk has to do with the actual text that you have." I said, "Is that possible? 7%. So you heard that right. 93% of what effective public speaking about is about everything else. 38% is what I sound like. My inflection in my voice, my pacing, my animation, my gravitas." So when you feel that, the oral experience is actually much more than the actual text in terms of the effect a public speaker has. Can you guess what the last 55% of it is? Take a guess. 55% of the effectiveness of a public speaker, this is from experts that I had to pay for coaching, is visual. So I guess apparently instead of working on this paper, I should have worried more about what shoes I was wearing this morning. At first I thought, this is unbelievable. I don't really buy it. But once I learned this teaching, I have to say I saw it, its truth, everywhere I went. And it wasn't just about public speaking. It was about worship and ritual. About a week after I'd learned this, I happened to go to a wedding. I was officiating a wedding in Chicago. And while I hope that I offered beautiful words to the couple and I sang beautiful songs, the moment where everybody cried, the moment that was truly transformative, was the processional. This bride, the minute she walked in, the look on everyone's face and the way it just immediately lit up the room, the tender look of her parents as they hugged her goodbye, and that sense that they knew she was leaving their home and making a new home. That was all captured non-verbally, just the wedding processional. And then that same week, oh, I had a picture for you. That same week, I went to a church, Trinity United, in Chicago with my family that weekend. And it's a traditionally black church led by my friend, the Reverend Otis Moss. And we were mesmerized by this place. And my children, who were complaining about going to church, were totally transfixed. They know how to do worship there. And I promise you, only a little bit was about the words. Are you ready? Are you ready? Are you ready for the coming of the Lord? That's not what did it. Perhaps it was, perhaps it was the 150-person volunteer choir that sang there every week. Just take a listen to the Trinity United Choir. But now, watch them. I hope. They're all in African-American garb, and they're behind the preacher. So you're watching them, they're moving in unison, and I'm sorry. You can't help but dance with them. So I'll admit that that visual, ironically, was not a great visual because it's hard to see their faces, but that was the best clip I could get of them. But the feeling of watching them, even if I didn't hear a thing, watching their bodies move and dance and pray and the expressions on their faces and their arms moving, that was the experience. So I started to understand the truth of moving beyond the text in terms of transformative ritual and transformative worship and liturgy. Now, as Jews, I don't want to say that text isn't important. If you don't have the right text in front of you, you can't speak it with a compelling voice, and you can't authentically get behind it. But one of the things I'd like to ask are, can we ask questions about our worship and our ritual that get us to the other 93% instead of just thinking about always our words? Questions we might want to ask include, what's the emotional arc and energy of a service? What are we building toward? Is there a way that we're building up to that Lachat Odi and you feel it not just with the text but with the music and even perhaps with your movement? What is that choreography of transitions as well between prayers or songs that create flow? A lot of times as a cantor, one of the things I think of are there the keys moving from one song to another so there's a sense that it's not awkward one song or another. I often think that the prayers are like muscles, but the transitions are all the sinews that allow those muscles to move together into a dance of worship. Think about who is in the room. Where are they coming from? Do you have a group of regulars or non-Jews or visitors? Who is in that space with you? And can you think about the kind of week they had when they walk into that space? And how do we create moments for connection, either between clergy? One of the things that we do at Central a lot is think about our own relationships with each other, because all of that's conveyed visually when we step onto the bima with each other, I hope. I have a few people who can tell me if it's actually true or not. So these are some of the questions that we started asking as a clergy team as we thought about worship, not just the text, but asking, can we think about this other 93%? What I wanted to do was share with you two instances of liturgical change that we took on at Central as examples of some of the way we think about prayer. The first I'd like to share with you is looking at the Kol Nidre service. Now, we looked at this service about 4 years ago, and I can promise you that the power of the Kol Nidre is not the text of the Kol Nidre prayer itself. I'm just going to read a little bit of it for you in translation. All vows we are likely to make, all oaths and pledges we are likely to take, between this Yom Kippur and the next Yom Kippur, we publicly renounce. Let them all be relinquished and abandoned, null and void, neither firm nor established. I'm pretty sure that these were the terms and conditions of my last online purchase. Now, we ask ourselves, if that's not what's compelling people, what is it about Kol Nidre? Now, I would argue as a cantor, I think a lot of it is the melody, especially if you've got the right cantor singing it. But I think there's something else people are connecting to on a deep level when they come in for a Kol Nidre service. And we tried to get and evoke the themes that people are really thinking about when they hear that melody sung or perhaps played on a cello. And we realized that we thought that these were the themes that people really felt when they were coming in for Kol Nidre. The idea that memory was a huge part of a Kol Nidre service, both memory of being at Kol Nidre services with loved ones before, a sense of memory and history with other Jews. The second was an opportunity to feel vulnerable, that we were able to bare our souls on this Kol Nidre night, especially because it was evening and something about the mood, that this was a huge part of what Kol Nidre was for people. And the last was a sense of return, the opportunity for tshuva, to come back to our best selves. So one question we had as we thought about these themes was, how could we create a sense of flow that would help people enter into these ideas. And if we were to actually think of the energy and flow of a traditional Kol Nidre service, what do we have? We have about 5 minutes, and then suddenly we're at the Kol Nidre. Kol Nidre comes right at the beginning of services, and whether you're warmed up for it as clergy or as the congregation or not, and then it's hard for inevitably it not to feel a little bit like the whole rest of the service is downhill from that. So we tried a radical concept to start. We said, what if we don't actually do the Kol Nidre at the beginning of the service, at least not in its entirety? And we decided instead to do just one line of the Kol Nidre at the beginning of the service, and then to do a little bit more later in the service, and then not to do the full Kol Nidre until the third time, if there's a tradition to do it three times, in its entirety. And at that point, we're already halfway through the service. And with each one of those tellings, we introduced this theme, one of these themes. So we asked Rabbi Larry Hoffman if he would be willing to write introductions for each of these themes before each Kol Nidre. And I just want to share with you the one before memory. So if you could for a minute, because you have to get in the mood, if you close your eyes and just imagine yourself in your shul on Kol Nidre night, what the pew feels like or the chair underneath your tushy, and whether or not you're surrounded by your family or perhaps you're on the bima if you're a clergy person. If you imagine that you're there and you hear this introduction to memory, like no other prayer, Kol Nidre compels our presence, and not just us alone, but the memorized outline, too, of younger years. The gentle feel of those who tucked us in, who blessed our days, consoled our nights, and came as we do on this eve with memories of their own. We tonight are memories in the making, warming seats for others who will remember us in some Kol Nidre they shall hear when we are gone. Now, I'll tell you, Larry Hoffman can deliver more than your average 7%. But I think that this was just a starting point. In addition to the rearranging of our Kol Nidre and this new text which introduced what we thought people really connected to with the Kol Nidre prayer, we also thought about choreography. When we came to return, we actually had the rabbis come down from the bima, walk to the back of the sanctuary, retrieve two Torah scrolls that had not been in the ark through the whole summer, lowered the lights, cantor sang Or Zeruah, and as they brought that Torah back home to its ark, it symbolized in a very powerful way and profound way, as we did the Kol Nidre for the first time in its entirety there in that service, the potential for this holiday for return and coming home. So I just share with you that as one example of how powerful it could be when we actually thought about a lot of things, including the text, but also beyond the text. Our current project now, which we've been working on actually for more than a year, is our Shabbat morning service, the service at which our children, like many other Reform synagogues, become bar and bat mitzvah. Now, at these services, we generally have a different congregation every week. Is that what it's like in your place as well? I'm going to imagine many of whom are, you know, guests of the B'nai Mitzvah at the time. This is the kind of thing that many clergy lament and complain about. Oh, they don't know our prayers. They're not generally here. So the first thing we did was change our mindset. And we thought, wait a minute. We have a brand new captive audience every morning. On Saturday morning, we realized it was more than 15,000 people a year that we have, many of whom are not even Jewish, where we have to share with them what is most powerful and beautiful and relevant about the Jewish tradition. So here's that opportunity. What are we going to do with it? And the first thing we thought was, could we find ways that people, even who are not Jewish at all, could enter into the sacredness and the relevancy of our tradition? What are the universal themes that we could look at with our particularistic Jewish language? So, for example, one of the things that we reworked was the section around the Shema. And there are three blessings that surround the Shema with the themes of creation and revelation and redemption. And we thought to ourselves, could we make it such that people would not just think of these as stories that happened once upon a time, long ago in ancient history, but were actually master narratives that were continually happening in their own lives? So to that end, we actually asked Dara Horn, who was a Jewish author, if she would write new liturgies that would enable people to get inside these prayers. So here's a story of creation. You once walked through a garden, past a tree you saw each day, and fell hushed by a surprise. A perfect round egg enfolded in a nest, trembling from the possibility within it. You once stood on the ocean's edge as water rushed toward invisible gates and heard the silent voice that told the waves, this far and no farther. Or you clutched your parents' shrunken fingers as they waited for the end and knew that just as they bore you into this world, it was your task to bear them to the next. So again, and this was just an excerpt of what she did for each of them, once again, I think we might have did better than 7% on the text, but this was one of the first steps we took, first asking the questions of who is in the room, what would they respond to, how could we make this feel relevant, and then asking questions like, what is this going to sound like as a heard experience? We actually alternate voices on lines with Cantor and Rabbi and sometimes congregation so that people don't just let it all run together. We actually added some visuals. This is one picture that we put in, among others. Just this is actually this beautiful nest. But the idea being that people respond and are evoked in their sense of worship and ritual in lots of different places. Can we reach and think about some of those other places? The next thing we did was ask the question, what are we communicating non-verbally? Actually, the literal question we asked was, if an alien dropped down into our service, what would the alien think was important to Jews? We were worried that maybe the alien would think, these Jews deify 13-year-olds who wear religious garb of exceedingly short skirts. And, you know, this is not what we wanted to communicate. And we realized we wanted to think about what was really communicated as very important to us as Jews. Now, at a service where a child is becoming bar bat mitzvah, everyone says, what should be the peak moment? You tell me. I think you all know. We want it to be when that child is called to the Torah for an aliyah, the highest honor we can offer. But I'll tell you, we could see in the congregation, generally speaking, that by the time we got to the Torah service, the body language was hunker down for a bunch of Hebrew that we were probably not going to be as committed to. We actually thought, what is the way that we're leading up in our service to this Torah service? Are we doing this in a way that people can really understand its importance? We literally graphed this out. I don't know if you can see this very well. This was our service the way we had it. I don't know if you can see. But we start, you know, I'm just starting with the Avot and Gevurot. But we stand for the Avot and Gevurot, and we get to this Kedusha, and I have to say, the Kedusha is a high moment. We do this beautiful version I did at the Biennial by Skloff that ends with these hallelujahs. It's grand and beautiful. But then you take all that energy, and we go to silent prayer. And we realize that it felt like the energy kind of left the room in silent prayer, and that Kedusha didn't take us somewhere. Then we had the Hakafah, which suddenly was a jump up of energy. That's where you see the graph going up. And then the Torah pass came down, and then the Torah reading, and Haftarah was really never quite a highlight. And then I didn't put the rabbi's sermon because, depending on the day, it was either up or down from there. But and we thought, what if we were willing to rearrange this and think differently about this and think that every step should be building in emotional energy and actually musical energy and flow towards Torah. So we actually thought, let's play with this a little bit. And this is actually the order we do now. We put the silent prayer after the Shema and her blessings. So after those beautiful Dara Horn readings, as you read, around creation, revelation, redemption, we gave people a moment of silence so they could actually reflect on those themes in their own lives. And that way also, silent prayer happened before. And then we got to Avot and Gvurot and Kedusha, and we were building. And as we're singing the hallelujah, hallelujah, the ark opens, and it's central. It's a big ark. And that child is up there. And that Torah comes out, and then it's passed down through the generations of their family. And then as it's been passed to them, we moved it so it was so that then they brought the Torah out to the people through the Hakafah. And then when they got up there to read Torah, it was clear that they were taking their place in this community in a very different way. And then we added Siman Tov at the end of their thing. I called it the exclamation point. And it was when everyone joined in and they stood up. And suddenly, this Torah service, felt completely different. If you asked a congregant, maybe they would say, I'm not really sure what they changed, but they knew that the feeling was completely different. This time it was clear that the Torah service even to an alien, was a mountaintop experience. And that our children stood at Sinai, and our parents cried. And even the non-Jews in the room knew they were part of a sacred drama. So these are just a few of the things that we did. And ultimately, what I'd say, all of it is about the text, the choreography, the flow, the music. It's all to some greater end, which is ultimately connection. Because truly transformative worship and ritual is all about connection. If I were to connection between us and our tradition, connection between clergy and congregant, between congregant to each other, and perhaps a connection for all of us with something much bigger than ourselves, perhaps God. So if I were to sum up this entire talk, which I have to come to a close pretty soon on, into three words, this is what I'd say. It's connection before content. And I have a proof text for you from the Talmud. What benediction do the priests say before offering God's blessing? Rabbi Zera said in the name of Rav Hista, "Blessed are you, Lord our God, sovereign of the universe, who sanctified us with the holiness of Aaron and commanded us to bless God's people with love." Now, before Aaron and the priest could bless the people, he had to make a bracha. He had to ask God, "Please help me first connect. Please help me first love." Because if there is not that sense of compassion and empathy and understanding and knowing where people are at, even if you don't know them, if there is not that sense of connection and love, then our prayers really don't have efficacy. They're not absorbed. They don't transform us. And now, how remarkable that our own Aaron, Rabbi Aaron Pankin, soon to be high priest of HUC, he embodies this teaching so fully. Like his biblical namesake, he is an Ohev Yisrael, a lover of Israel. And you feel it in the way he listens, the way he speaks to you, the way he looks you in the eye and inquires after your family. He is a brilliant scholar, but he begins first with connection, with love. And that is why it's such a blessing to be his student, or to be his colleague, or to be his friend. So as we soon, in a few hours, will together join him for a mountaintop experience, for a ritual moment of installation when he becomes the new head, president of Hebrew Union College, I hope that in that moment, he will feel that our connection to him is beyond words. Thank you. Thank you. I think I even stuck kind of the timeline here. So I have, about 15, 20 minutes, right? Someone's going to tell me when I only have 5. So I have at least 15 minutes for some conversation. I'd love for it to be conversation. I'll get in front of this now here. Yes, Mike. I would be very happy to share any of it. I mean, I think that we have a number of clergy who come through, and sometimes when they're coming through New York with their confirmation class or sometimes on sabbatical, we've often had clergy. We've even had some clergy sit in on our sessions where we work on clergy together. We work with Janet Walton, who is a liturgical consultant. She's been working with Central Synagogue for over 15 years. I didn't want to not say that, but I also didn't want it to feel like you can only do this work if you have a consultant. But it does help to have someone who keeps our feet to the fire and asks us some of these questions. But I would say that we are very happy to share any of it. I mean, ultimately, if someone asked me to do a session on this, I would do it. I mean, they asked me to do this session, and I'm doing it. And I'd be happy to share with anyone, really. Yes, please. Please tell me your name, too.
Don Simon.
Don. Right. Oh, thank you, Don. Right. We met, and I'm sorry. A good question. For the Shabbat morning service, I said it's still in evolution, and we've done different stages of this. We actually brought people in to think about some of these themes with us. We actually had different people try to write them before we went to Darahorn, and I have to admit they weren't very good. So the text does still matter, because if you don't feel like you can get inside it, then you can't deliver it. Then we also did several practice services with people, and we got their feedback. So what was interesting is, remember how I graphed for you that the Haftarah really seemed to not be a high point, and we couldn't get our families to really engage in Haftarah? We tried an experiment of practicing a service at our sixth grade retreat with our sixth grade families where we did no Haftarah. We decided instead we were going to take prophetic teachings, and that the children would prepare a prophetic teaching from, you know, the top 10 prophetic texts, and deliver it earlier in the service, and our people went crazy. They said, you can't take out the Haftarah. They're going to do Haftarah like I did Haftarah. And it was interesting. So we are not yet moving the Haftarah. So, but I'm just saying that it is a process where we've come up with things, then we've introduced changes to the congregation, and we've taken feedback. So at each one of our last three retreats, actually, as we've been working on it, we've actually had what I'd call a lab service, where we've invited the people at our sixth grade retreat to actually respond immediately after the service with feedback. And with the Kol Nidre service, we did a three-session study session on Kol Nidre leading up to the High Holidays, where we introduced some of these themes and also introduced and warned people that there were some changes coming. Yes?
Do you have Alan?
That's a good question. We do not generally have visual tefillah. We do not have a screen on the board. I think up on the bima, except for occasionally for special occasions. This coming Friday is our service where we pay tribute to Rabbi Peter Rubenstein, who's retiring, and there we're going to have a screen because we have a special video. I think part of it is both that people love our sanctuary, and if we put a big screen up there, I don't know. I think people would have a hard time if that was up there every week. But it is something we are thinking about, for sure. And I know that some places do it with great success. Yes? Yes, Doreen, thank you.
How do the older congregants, the longtime congregants, feel about the change? Do you get negative comments from them?
Sam and Ruth are there for everything. And, you know, but you're not our normal congregants. But I would say that, I mean that only in the best way. I would say that there's been nothing but completely positive response to Saturday morning, because what we've done in the actual sanctuary, we've gotten some negative feedback in our lab service where we've tried some more radical things. But what we've done and introduced in the Saturday morning, I think people have overwhelmingly been very happy with. With Kol Nidre, we got almost no response. I will say that one of the thoughts we had in terms of a visual tefillah is, you know, it's traditional to wear a tallit on Kol Nidre evening, right? The only night that you are to wear a tallit. And we thought, wouldn't this be beautiful if we got everyone to wear a tallis on Kol Nidre night? And then at one point, we thought we would actually have them all lift them up, and they'd be like wings across the whole congregation. We thought it would be such a stunning visual. Well, they didn't like that. I mean, meaning like nobody came. We tried to sell, bring your tallit. We put tallitot in all of the pews. But there's still enough of a remnant of our classical reform congregation that people were like, I'm not putting on a tallis. So it was okay. We learned as we went along, and we didn't push the tallis thing the next year. And but I would say that we, in terms of major pushback, in terms of not doing Kol Nidre as the first thing, we did not, and that was actually surprising. I think one of the things that we did, which was very wise, is this whole service began with a cello playing the Bruch Kol Nidre. So if people felt like they needed to hear their Kol Nidre first thing, they did, but it was just not the recitation of it, it was the cello playing it. So maybe that's why we didn't get anybody upset that they didn't hear it right away. Yes?
Jennifer Kaufman from Bnei Israel in Sacramento. How did you deal with physical text stuff when you're making these changes in terms of doing Kol Nidre at various times or changing the order in the Shabbat morning service?
So we did, you know, we did have to make a new prayer book is what we did. And we have reprinted ones for each one of our High Holiday services as we've worked on a new one. I will say that we print them nice enough so that they look nice, but not nice enough that they feel like they're permanent and forever. Because there is a sense that we are always evolving and changing. And I think that we kind of anticipate that the average lifespan of any one of our services is 4 to 6 years. And so I think that's a piece of it, is that we do end up doing that. And then we struggle because Friday night we do use Mishkan Tefillah, but when we try to add some of these things, we're struggling with how much you have to announce page numbers because you're flipping through. And when you do the insertions, we have an order of service, and we print things that are not in the prayer book on our order of service so that we don't have to, you know, go back and forth so much. So, but it's still a challenge. I think ultimately we've talked about with Mishkan Tefil, I think that's going to happen with the Machzor, that congregations could actually pick and choose their selections and create their own prayer book out of the master volume, which I think will be a great new innovation. Yes?
Yeah, Stuart Cohen, Marblehead Mass. In our congregation, you're saying that this change basically came from the clergy body. In our congregation, the rabbis always had the feeling that change of this nature should come from the congregants, including the board. That makes for a very different dynamic. Any thoughts on that?
You know, I think it's a very hard thing to put this only in the hands of congregants, because there is a way that, you know, I hope that 5 years of studying liturgy and being engaged in on a regular basis teaches us something. That doesn't mean, though, that there's not a lot that can be learned from congregants. And we have had congregants brought into our liturgical change process at different times to offer their perspective and also their learning, and this is what it feels like when we're sitting in the pew, as well as the interactive process as we're trying things out and experimenting. My response would be, I hope it could be a partnership in some way. And it might be that in some congregations, some of this, the lead is taken by lay leaders, and in some congregations, the lead is going to be taken by clergy, but I think there has to be some sense that you're both working on this together in some way.
Angela, yeah.
5 minutes. All right. Yes, please.
I'm Rabbi Jonathan Perlman from Cincinnati. I've thought about these issues for a long time. I'm so glad you're giving voice to it in a beautiful way. I have two questions. One is that in more traditional synagogues, the Shliach Tzibur faces the Ark and is addressing God as one of the congregation. And in most conservative Reform synagogues, Reconstruction synagogues, the clergy faces the congregation. Mm-hmm. And it's a very different sense of to whom are you praying?
Yeah.
You're watching the clergy, how are they dressed? What's their makeup look like? You know, what's their hair? I was wondering if you've thought about that at all, of perhaps turning all the time, part of the time, and being part of the congregation. My other question is about the regulars. So there's the issue of Bar Mitzvah Factory, and what happens to the regulars who don't need the pages being announced, don't need to walk through the service, and in many congregations, of which I'm a member now, there's often every week it's saying, here's Aleph, here's Bet's, and for the regulars, it's like, we know that this is not the kind of service we want to go to.
Okay, you asked a lot of really good questions, and they gave me the 5 minute, but I'm going to try to give you a quick response. One, I think that there are moments in the service where we turn around and we're not facing the congregation, the Amidah, the Baruch Hu. There are times when I think it is really appropriate, and I think when we talk about the visual, it's not just like looking at someone's face or certainly their outfit. It's really, are you connecting in a way and having the visual experience of seeing something authentic in front of you? And I think sometimes when you see a person praying, even if their back is to you, if they're really praying, you can feel that even without looking at their face. And so I think that the visual of that is profound whatever way you're doing it. For me, I find that when I'm leading and I can actually look at the faces of the people I'm with, I feel I'm genuinely connecting with their story as we're doing it. And I incredibly feed off of the energy of my community, and it's different every week. In terms of regulars and guests, I think for Shabbat morning, we've also rewritten the Saturday morning prayer book in part because we had so many additional readings. And so we don't have to announce page numbers. People can kind of follow along. But I will be honest that our regulars generally come to our Friday night service over our Saturday morning service. And I guess that's sort of a choice the Reform movement kind of consciously took at some point. And we certainly fall into that camp. And we read Torah on Friday night for that reason as well. So, yes, Rabbi.
One thank you.
Oh, thank you. Thank you.
How do you also deal, one aspect you didn't touch on, that can't be changed, is architecture. I know your synagogue, we have a 1950s Percival Goodman, and even though we built chapels for smaller venue, whatever, and incidentally, when we built our chapel in the round, many people have expressed an uncomfortability because we designed it so everybody looks at everybody's face.
Right.
Have no privacy.
Right.
You know, we're supposed to all frontal. But how do you transcend or deal with the structure that you can't change?
Right, so we'll all be in Plum Street, and Central Synagogue looks a lot like Plum Street on the inside, and we have balconies. And I remember when I auditioned for my position more than 9 years ago, I guess 9 years ago, I remember thinking to myself, oh my gosh, how do you create community in this place? Because I was by myself with like 12 people, the interview committee, seated across this huge sanctuary. And I thought, that's going to be hard. But the reality is, you can both transcend it with, you know, warming up the space with everything you can, including sound and music, but also playing with the space as you can. So we always start the service, for example, off the bima. We come down onto the floor, and that makes a big difference. And also at the moment we do the Misha Berach prayer, we come down from the bima. And just the coming down from the bima is already makes a huge statement, I think, and makes the feel very different. And you don't always have to be down, but when you are sometimes and you play with that a little bit, I think that makes a difference. We did end up after the fire having to redo the bima, and one of the things we did was lower the steps so that actually we're on a different level than we were before, and that made a big difference. So I think that you're right. There are ways that you can use that to your advantage. I will say one advantage is I feel like I can do some of the things when I play guitar in that beautiful grand sanctuary. People don't think of it being quite as much like camp in some way because we're in that grand space. So, you know, sometimes you can try to use to advantage what your space does for you and then and try to work on the other side of it around it. Anyway, we're just exploring the beginning of this. Is this my, like?
This is it.
All right, so, but I'm available and I thank you for joining this morning.